How many of you are easily offended? A few of you.
What do you mean by that?
All right. I'm glad to see some of you had the courage to raise your hands. How many of you know someone who's easily offended? All right. You know, it's funny. Last week we were talking about what happens in the second half of life. That the second half of life has a way of just making things real, stripping away the superfluous things, and changing us from the inside out in ways that we hadn't expected, ways that we never anticipated. And it's a beautiful thing when we allow ourselves to age gracefully, if we're not constantly fighting it and trying to stay back where we were, because we have this sense in our head of who we're supposed to be, and it's not this guy that's staring back at me in the mirror anymore. You know, I think of myself. Don't we all? Those of you who are in the second half of life, you know, you still remember yourself a certain way and feel a certain way, and then you look in the mirror. Who is that guy? It's strange. You see a picture of yourself, and it takes you a second to realize, oh yeah, okay. But if we allow ourselves to move and flow into our age, things happen. Things change. We talked about the phenomenon of a person who simply changes mind, changes sides, but nothing changes underneath. We talked about a young man who was an alcoholic and took pleasure in drinking all his friends under the table, and when he saw the error of his ways, became a monk, and then took pleasure in fasting all his fellow monks under the table, and nothing really changed. He just changed sides. We talked about Saul of Tarsus, how he was an absolute adamant defender of the faith of Judaism to the point where he was killing and exiling and doing all sorts of persecution among this new sect of Jews, these followers of Jesus of Nazareth. And then he found his own conversion on the road to Damascus. And then he was an absolute staunch defender of the Gentiles in their pursuit of following Jesus to the point that he was fighting with everybody in sight. And we talked about how at that point in his life, he hadn't really changed. He changed sides, but the part of him that was still putting position over relationship was alive and well and very intact. But then as we move on and we look at his letters to the Philippians, and especially his last letters before he died to Timothy, we see a fundamental change taking place in Paul. We see instead of all of the emphasis on the position, all of the emphasis on what's right and wrong by some standard that he had set and a judgment that he thought was valid, we see him caring simply about the people that he's with. We see him telling us that he learned to be content in all of his circumstances. Frank kind of stole my thunder and read one of the very scriptural passages that we're going to talk about today. And that's perfect. I love that kind of synchronicity when it happens. We're on a beam. I don't know what that means when I say I'm on a beam with Frank. It's a little frightening, but there it is. Maybe it'll help me barbecue. I don't know. I'm trying to figure this out. He's a master barbecuer, for those of you who don't get that inside joke. But the second half of life can bring change naturally. It can happen. But it's like those... We talked about those Nazca lines in Peru, those drawings that are so big on the plains of the desert in southern Peru that you got to get some perspective. You got to be in the air. You got to be on the surrounding mountaintops to be able to see the patterns and see what's going on. Life is like that. You need the perspective to be able to see. It's something about just having lived 2, 3, 4 decades to be able to see the patterns of life that are large enough that you're not going to get them necessarily in your 20s and early 30s. What's a midlife crisis all about? And I believe the midlife crisis comes at midlife, in the mid-30s. That's the first time. You finally lived enough time that you can see that you're going to get old and die like everybody else. You're starting to see those patterns in yourself. You're starting to see your body change, your face change. And you know that you have to fit in to the normal pattern. You are now your parents and you thought you'd never be. It's stuff like that that happens. And so going forward requires a choice. Am I going to try to hold on to the image of myself that I have from my 20s, or am I going to allow myself to become whatever it is I become in my 40s, 50s, 60s, and on? Can I do that? Can I make that shift? And what does that look like? A midlife crisis is always a crisis of meaning and purpose. It's a crisis of identity. Who am I? As a child, as an adolescent, as a young adult, we had a certain identity. We were grabbing on and holding on to things that always fall in the roles and the accomplishments and the attributes. Doesn't go deeper than that, usually. Very few young people can get down to the center of things. And so the midlife crisis hits, and we have to figure out, why are we going to live the next 35 years? Why are we going to live the next 40 or 50 years? It's about these things. It's about these questions. And age, as it moves on, strips away all the illusions and delusions and the arrogance of youth in a way that is inescapable. We still have a choice. We can allow it to take us where it needs to go, or we can fight it, fight it, fight it, and many of us do. We talked about the fact that usually to grow older is to grow wiser. Some people just grow older, and it's sad, but it happens. And so if we're going to allow old age in the second half of life to take us where we really want to go, we'll find that the second half of life brings a freedom. It brings a freedom of not having to hold on to all of that baggage in your head, have to hold on and defend all of that notion of who you are and yourself and all of the things that you're supposed to be doing and should be doing and places you're supposed to be and the way you're supposed to look and all those things that dominate all of our thinking can be finally laid down in the second half of life unless we decide to try to do something about it first. And so the question that we asked last week that we want to continue with this week is that, do you have to get old in order to get free? Do you have to get old to find this fundamental real change? Does it have to occur in the second half of life? And the answer is no, of course not. It can be easier in the second half of life, but it can happen as soon as we want. Jesus' way is the way to freedom. He said it over and over again. Follow me, and you will know the truth, and the truth will make you free. Free from what? Free from the fear that causes the false identity that causes all of these dysfunctional behaviors. We talked about the fact that Jesus' way is like a rite of passage, properly understood. It's like a hero's journey, properly understood, that has the three elements of separation from our normal world, a transition period, and then a reincorporation. And so when you think about Jesus' way in that respect, like a rite of passage, like this hero's journey, what it is really doing is creating an awareness in us and a valuing in us of everything that God is. If we started in the unity of the garden as infants, as children, we went through the separation of our age of reason, of metaphorically eating from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and are living in the transition right now of trying to find our way to reincorporate back into the garden, back into the unity that is our God, then we first have to be aware that that's the journey itself. We have to value what God values in his being of unity and connection. And what are those elements? What are the things that God values? Jesus tells us straight out. Look at the Beatitudes. The Beatitudes at the beginning of Mark 5, at the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount, paint the picture of what someone looks like who is living this reincorporation, who is living this return to the garden and return to unity. And if you think about the aspects there, the attributes there, who is that person who's living in kingdom and connecting? He's unassuming. She is unassuming. Meek, gentle, empathic. That's what mourning is. Being empathetic, connecting, feeling another person's pain. Merciful, undiverted, passionate, and enduring. All of those elements are there in those Beatitudes. A person who has gone through transition and coming back into this connection with their God, those are the prerequisites. You can't have kingdom, Jesus says, unless you can be humble, unless you can see this connection with everyone. And the trouble is that in our society, we don't value these attributes anymore. We don't value meekness. We don't value gentleness. We don't, certainly don't value mournfulness. Our society is all built on something else. It goes into different directions. But these traits are necessary if we're going to actually follow this way of Jesus, actually come back to the garden the way Jesus would have us do and connect with him. I've made the comment, I think in here and several, it's become kind of a phrase that I use now when I'm working with someone for the first time, and I tell them that I am now unoffendable about theological issues and religious issues. Talk about whatever you want to talk about. It doesn't matter to me. You know, I am unoffendable. In fact, I want to hear different opinions. I want to know that people have different thoughts. If everybody in this room thought like me, then only one person is thinking for himself or herself. That's the way that works. Everybody has to take this journey for themselves. Nobody can take it for you. And so we're all going to end up with different thoughts, different understandings, different conceptions. That's okay. Let's talk about them. I wasn't always unoffendable about these things. I guarded and defended my boundaries, my beliefs, passionately. I blew up Bible studies, had people yelling and screaming at each other. And the last time I did that, I swore I would never put position over relationship again, and I've tried really hard to do that over the last 15 or so years. And after a while, you just realize there's no more buttons there. It's okay if you think something different than I do. I'm no longer offendable. So I said that to someone in a counseling session, a friend of mine. We were talking, and I said, you know, I'm unoffendable about things having to do with... And he says, not possible. He just threw up, not possible. And he said it with a certainty, like the sun is going to rise tomorrow. You know, the Dodgers are not going to win the pennant. It's just not possible. It's not going to happen. You know, it's just, it was that kind of... And so I didn't even bother to argue with him because he had a made-up mind. And you know, made-up mind is kind of like a made-up bed. It's all neat and tidy and smooth and the corners are sharp. And you don't even want to sit on it. You don't want to mess it up. So you just want to leave it just perfectly until you have to get in bed and then you try to get in bed. You know, it's like that. Made-up mind is kind of like that. Don't mess with my mind. It's made up. It's neat. It's clean. Okay? It makes sense to me. And so you just kind of let it go. But the fact remains, I really am unoffendable on these issues. Now, I'm not unoffendable at everything, but what I figured out was the things that still offend me are the things that I'm afraid might be true. I don't know if I've told you in here this before, but you know, if you want to call me a fat Asian man, it's not really going to bother me too much. I'd like to lose 10 or 15 pounds. That would be great. But I'm not really fat, and I'm certainly not Asian. And so something like that, a perceived insult, is not going to hit me anywhere that matters. But tell me I'm a bad father, and I'm going to writhe inside because my job has taken me sideways with my family, and I haven't spent the time that I should spend with my kids. And that's something that I'm afraid might be true. And it really, really rankles. It really hurts to hear that. We all have things that we are offendable over, and hopefully we have things that we have learned not to be offended anymore. The Desert Fathers, these ancient Christians from the 3rd and 4th century, made a huge deal about learning to be unoffendable. And there's stories that survive in their writings that tell about their working with young people in their communities, trying to get them to understand this. There was one elder, and the text says that he had advanced to the point that he no longer took any notice of wickedness. I mean, we've talked about this in here before. It doesn't even sound ethical. It doesn't sound moral. It doesn't sound right to our ears that it should be lauded, it should be approved, that you advance to the point that you take no notice of wickedness. And the story goes that a young woman who was made pregnant and out of wedlock is brought to him for punishment, and he won't do it. He refuses to punish her, give her a penance. Instead, he orders that 6 pairs of fine linens be given to her for the childbirth. And the younger brothers who brought her in are outraged. Give her a punishment! You know, what am I to do, brothers? She could be near to death, her or the child. I'm going to give what's needed. No judgment, no notice of wickedness, just responding to what was needed at the moment. There's a story of a young monk who comes to an elder and says, what must I do to get closer to the Lord? He says, I want you to go to the cemetery. You might have heard this one before. And I want you to praise the dead. So he goes to the cemetery and he's praising at all the headstones. Comes back to the mother. He says, "Brother," he says, "did you do it?" He goes, "Yeah." "Did they respond to you?" He says, "No." "I want you to go back to the cemetery and insult the dead." And he goes dutifully and does that. Comes back. "Did you do it?" "Yes." "Did they respond to you?" "No." When you can respond to the praises and insults of men the way the dead do, then you will become closer to the Lord. Another story goes that a man ordered one of his students, one of the brothers, younger brothers, to pay someone every time they insulted him. He got an insult, he had to pay them. And he did this for like several years, and he really didn't understand why. And then he goes to a city in Greece, and there is an old sage, kind of a blind one of these weird guys who sits at the city gates insulting everybody who comes in. And he insults this young brother as he comes in. He just starts laughing. He says, "Why do you laugh?" He says, "Because I used to have to pay for this kind of thing, and now you give it to me for free." And the old crusty man says, "Come on in, the city is yours." There is this idea of the freedom that comes when we are not moved by the offenses and the perceived insults of others. When we can be unoffendable. And what does that mean? That means we're free to be exactly who we are, when we exactly are. That we don't have to be someplace else, do something else. That when the insults come, we can take them for their face value, but they don't offend us. What kind of freedom is that? Think about that. Now, to the desert fathers and mothers, this was a spiritual goal. For us, is it a spiritual goal? Is it really? Because we have to think through this a little bit. It is so foreign to our culture and to the way that we were brought up that we have to think, is it really something that we should be doing? Is it a goal for us spiritually? And the question, we talked about this on Wednesday night in the study that Frank was talking about. And one of the questions that came up, I think maybe I asked it just to stir the pot a little bit, was that, can God be offended? If God is our guide, then can God be offended? And of course, I suppose to a certain extent it's an unanswerable question, but I think there are clues there. There are things that we can look at. Now, it was pointed out by several people that the Bible contains passages talking about offenses to God, talking about God's anger to the offenses of men. But when you really think about it, those are offenses against God's law. God needed to act. There were consequences to the offense against the law. But was God personally offended? This is the question. Is God's law offended? Yes. Is God offended? We've got to talk about that for a second. Scott brought up the issue, if he saw a child being abused, he would be highly offended and he would be moved to do something, to intervene in some way. And now the question came between offending and defending. We talked about how we would hope that in that case, all of us would be moved to rush to the defense of that child. But do we need to be offended so that we can defend? Or are those two separate things? The truth of the matter is, being offended is always a form of defense. But the question is, what are we defending? What are we really defending when we are offended? If you take a look at the actual definition of offended, it's being resentful, annoyed, angered, or hurt over a perceived insult. That's the actual definition of offended. So when we are offended, what we are defending is really our own ego boundaries. It's really our own sense of self. It's really the sense of what it is that we are supposed to be identifying with, relating to, the things that are important to us. That's what we're defending. What we believe about our group, about our religion, about our ball team, whatever it happens to be, those are the things that we defend the most. I can't remember if I said last week or maybe it was Wednesday. All these things kind of merge for me after a while. So sorry if you hear a few stories over and over again. But early in my marriage with Marion, going to her parents' house, my in-laws, was kind of like entering a battle zone, because as soon as someone brought up the first thing about trade unions or politics, it was off to the races and everybody was yelling and screaming at each other and it got really heated. You know, over the years that has, I've watched that just tamper down, tamp down, tamp down. People are not as easily offended anymore, but it was a highly, highly offensive place because all of the identity was wrapped up in liberalism or conservatism or trade unions or free market. And all these issues, these big macro issues, were so highly loaded that you couldn't say the first word without causing offense and getting the predictable response. Does this really describe our God? Does God have ego boundaries that he needs to defend? Obviously, he defends us. Obviously, he has things that he values. He has his law. He has his own nature. But in the terms of the way that we are talking about being offended, does that really apply to God? It's a question you'll have to answer for yourself. You can tell by my bias and the way I'm putting it where I'm coming from, but you have to answer for yourself. And I'm unoffended if you disagree. It's okay. But answer the question. It is so incredibly important. Maybe we can take this a step further. Was Jesus offended? Now, maybe we have more evidence. I can certainly say that he was hurt. Absolutely. Don't you think Jesus was hurt? Do you remember there was one time where he was trying to teach of the deeper things to his followers, and he said, you have to eat my flesh and drink my blood to be in communion with me, to be in kingdom. And people just went apoplectic over that. That was such an absolute affront to everything that Jews believed. And he even asked them, does this offend you? Obviously it did. He tried to explain. They just got more heated. And finally, the scripture tells us that many stopped following him that day. And he turns to those who are left, his inner circle. And he says, will you also go away? That's the question of someone who's been hurt. Don't you think? He was a man like us. He had all the feelings that we have. Yes, he got hurt. Did he get angry? I don't know how you can look at the cleansing of the temple any other way than a flash of anger, can you? But think about this. As he was going through and overturning tables and doing what he did in that state, what was he defending? His own ego boundaries? Or was he defending the people who were being shunted aside, who were being shelved away from the direct experience and connection with their God? Because of the system that had been put in place. He was defending his people. He was trying to graphically remove, at least in their eyes, the things, the very things that blocked them from the true experience of their God. Paul, we talked about. Take a look at this. Actually, before we go to Paul, Matthew 11:2-6, I skipped over. This is Jesus talking to John, his cousin John the Baptist's disciples. John is in prison at this time. He doesn't know it yet, but he's not getting out of there. He's going to be beheaded. But he's also hearing all the stories of Jesus' ministry. This Jesus that he believed was the Messiah. Most scholars think that John the Baptist was probably an Essene, which is a messianic apocalyptic sect. They were waiting for this warrior king to come and raise an army, blow out the Romans, and establish a new kingdom, a new Israel. And he's hearing all these stories of Jesus. And when John was imprisoned, he heard the works of Christ. He sent word by his disciples and said to him, are you the expected one? And that very phrase, expected one, is the word that the Essenes used for the Messiah. Are you the expected one, or shall we look for someone else? John the Baptist, questioning, because Jesus wasn't meeting his expectations. What's going on here? What are you doing hanging around with prostitutes and tax collectors? You're supposed to be raising an army in his mind, or whatever it was he was thinking. Are you the expected one, or shall we look for someone else? And Jesus answered to his disciples and said, go and report to John what you hear and see. The blind receive sight, the lame will walk, the lepers are cleansed, and the deaf hear. The dead are raised up, and the poor have the gospel preached to them. And then he says, blessed is he who does not take offense at me. What is he saying there? I'm not what you expected. I'm poor. I come from a house of poverty. I am unassuming and meek and gentle and empathic and patient and persevering. I'm all these things, and you are impatient and wanting all these spectacular things to happen, and it's not happening. Are you going to be offended by that? Because I show your ego boundaries for what they are? Do you have to take offense? Jesus is asking. Paul at 2 Corinthians 12. Therefore, I am well content with my weaknesses, with insults, with distresses, with persecutions, with difficulties, for Christ's sake. For when I am weak, then I am strong. This is right after he tells us that he prayed fervently three times for God to take whatever thorn in his flesh was irritating him and annoying him and causing him all sorts of distress, and it wasn't going away. He gets to this point. And in Philippians 4:11, back in prison, I have learned to be content in whatever circumstances I am. Unoffendable. Not prone to have to defend ego boundaries. Jesus tells us at Matthew 7, verse 13, to enter through the narrow gate, for the gate is wide and the way is broad that leads to destruction, and there are many who enter through it. For the gate is small and the way is narrow that leads to life, and there are few who find it. We typically think of this as being the way to heaven and hell, but it has nothing to do with that in Aramaic sense. The kingdom is the quality of life that we're talking about right here and right now. That awareness of God's presence, that ability to exhibit all of those attributes of the Beatitudes in your life, in your choices, in your attitudes. But why is it so difficult? Why is it so hard to do that? I wanted to get myself in a little trouble here and read to you the opening lines of an ancient Chinese poem, the Sin Sin Ming, which literally is translated as faith in mind. And immediately it's going to sound like a contradiction. Listen to what he says in relation to what Jesus just said about the narrow gate and the narrow way. He writes, "The way is not difficult for those who have no preferences." The way is not difficult. And here the Chinese way is much like Jesus' way. It's understood much the same way. This way to connection. This way that flows with the Spirit of life, Spirit of God. The way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. When love and hate are both absent, everything becomes clear and undisguised. Make the slightest distinction, however, and heaven and earth are set infinitely apart. If you wish to see the truth, then hold no opinions for or against anything. To set up what you like against what you dislike is the disease of the mind. Now, immediately it sounds like he's contradicting Jesus, and if he really were, I wouldn't have read this to you, because I only read these crazy things when they agree, because Jesus is my way, okay? Just want to make that clear. But what he's actually saying is exactly the same thing as Jesus. Who among us has no preferences? Who among us is unoffendable? Who among us doesn't have things that we're biased toward or against? And as soon as we make those distinctions, the way is no longer easy. It's really, really hard. In fact, it's impossible. As long as you hold these preferences. And really what he's doing, he's blending Jesus' idea of the way and the gate being narrow and his injunction to us not to judge. He's putting the two things together. Jesus said at Matthew 7:1, "Do not judge so that you will not be judged. For in the way you judge, you will be judged. And by your standard of measure, it will be measured to you." The judgment is the setting of preferences. The judgment is the setting up of yourself to be offended by the standards that you set. Because these standards that we set to judge are standards for acceptability. They're standards for acceptance itself. And if we have any, then they apply to us before we even perpetrate them on anybody else. There are now standards for us to pass before we can be acceptable to each other, to ourselves, to God. And as soon as we've done that, the way becomes too narrow for us to pass. Sin Sing Ming is speaking in irony. It's easy if you have no preferences. But it is so hard to have no preferences, because every one of us wants to judge. It's what makes us feel safe in a fearful world. The judgment comes out of our fear. At the point that we finally don't have the preferences, at the point that we're not offendable anymore, at the point that we take no notice of wickedness, it means that a certain amount of this perfect love has come in and blown out the fear, allowing us to have the freedom to accept things as they are, to stop trying to recreate them in our own image so that we can feel a little bit secure. Jesus gives us the answer, flat out. Don't judge. As soon as you do, you're offendable. And as soon as you're offendable, you're no longer free. I wanted to read a little passage from the book that we're reading on Wednesday night because it's just so perfect. The offendable person is what Rohr is going to call the non-centered person, the eccentric person. He says, probably the most obvious indication of non-centered, eccentric people is that they are frankly very difficult to live with. Every one of their ego boundaries must be defended, negotiated, or worshipped. Interesting. Their reputation, their needs, their nation, their security, their religion, even their ball team. They convince themselves that these boundaries are all they have to worry about because they are the sum total of their identity. And that's the key. We think we are this thing we're defending. You can tell if you have placed a lot of your eggs in these flimsy baskets if you are hurt or offended a lot. You can hardly hurt saints because they are living at the center and do not need to protect the circumference of feelings and needs. Eccentric persons, though, are a hurt waiting to happen. In fact, they will create tragedies to make themselves feel alive. I am told that personnel work now represents 80% of the time and energy that American companies have to expend. Personnel work. You might even say that a certain degree of contemplative seeing is actually necessary for the effective life of an institution or a community. See, we're offended at what we fear might be true. What strikes at this self-image, this false image that we have of ourselves, this imagined identity that we have. Jesus' journey is the journey from fear to freedom. Freedom from being offended, to be exactly who we are. Being unoffendable, then, you can actually look at as the measure of your freedom in Christ. The measure of your experience of your absorbing of the perfect love of God. The idea and the knowledge that you're really accepted. All of that. This simple thing of being offended. If you're easily offended, what's going on? It gets easier in the second half of life, because a lot of the things that you're holding on to just don't exist anymore. Maybe it's your looks. Maybe it's your ability to play sport. Maybe it's your bank account. Whatever it is, things start to fall away with age. And if we will let them go, if we have learned to let them go, we are being changed. But we don't have to wait if we can just go on this way of Jesus. If there is a willingness to let go of the things that we realize we're clinging on to. Because the older you get, the harder it gets to cling on to those things. The more work it takes to get up and look a certain way in the morning, right? And all of that energy finally just becomes too much. Why am I still doing it? To what point? I ran across an essay that I just loved, and I cut it down, but I just want to read you just a part of it in closing, because it comes from someone well into the second half of life, and he calls this essay, "You Get Old." He writes, and I think he was pretty much anonymous. I couldn't find his name anywhere, but "You get old, and life gets small. Not meager or pinched, just small. You don't buy groceries for a week anymore. 2 hours in the local market, drenched in sweat with a grocery list that unrolls like the Dead Sea Scrolls. No, you get old. You shop every day with your list written on the cover of a matchbook. 2 pork chops, a can of green peas, 4 ears of corn, 2 for tomorrow, and 2 rolls of toilet paper. You get old. People don't notice you. You sit at a bar sipping your Jim Beam Black when a pretty woman in her 30s sits next to you. You smile and say hi while she looks at you and then through you around the bar. You get old. You lose your anger. It takes too much energy to be angry when you're old. You have more important things to do with your energy, and so you hoard it like a dwindling resource. You get old. You find that it's not always about you. You no longer wait for an opening in the conversation to talk about yourself, your dreams, your accomplishments. It becomes second nature to draw other people into talking about their lives. You're no longer the life of the party, making people laugh. You no longer have that neurotic compulsion to be known at any cost. Why should you? You get old. You know yourself. You get old. You need less. Less food, less booze, less sex, less sleep. One Jim Beam Black after dinner, savored so it lasts until you fall asleep. You get old. You get up at 4 a.m. as if to catch every moment of your fading days. You struggle out of bed, let the dogs out, make coffee, light a cigar, then go outside and get your newspaper. You sit there on the front steps smoking your cigar in the darkness until Jean-Pierre, the Haitian paper man, pulls up in his battered 25-year-old Toyota. He sees you and gets out to hand you the paper personally. Sorry, I'll be late today. No problem, Pierre. You get old. You realize that you have known Pierre for at least 5 years, but you never noticed until now that he is as black as a purple plum. You get old. You get colorblind. All you see is a hardworking man with both hands wrapped around the American dream, bending to his will. You get old. Your dogs get old, too. It never dawned on you that when you got them, all six of them, 1 year after another, that they would all get old 1 year after another and then die. Right now, they are all between 10 and 16 years old. Their lives are bounded by food and sleep and all the pills they take, which are lined up next to yours on the counter. That's an image, isn't it? You get old. Your circle of friends gets smaller. But your very best friends die in your arms. You get old. Small things give you pleasure that were once annoyances. Throwing out the garbage, you meet a neighbor walking his dog. You pet his dog. He pets yours. They both sniff butts, then collapse while you pass the time of day. You get old. You realize that order is freedom. You do your job more professionally, and you prepare for it in advance. No longer on the fly, trusting to fate and skill to see you through. You realize that being able to work at all is God's gift. When you were young, you thought you were God's gift. You get old. Your dreams constrict. You no longer expect fame and fortune, your face on the cover of Time magazine. You pretty much know by now that you're not going to write the next great American novel, 900 pages or less. Your posts get smaller, fewer words, but cleaner, you hope, more nuanced, less obvious, subtle, you like to think, just like your life. Small little essays about getting old, about fear, about death, dogs, and Democrats. Little things that you hope others will like. That will please you more than if you had written War and Peace. You get old. You cry more, a lot more. Not over your lost dreams, your sin, your old age, your impending death. No, you cry for others now. You cry when someone dies too young, at age 30, even in a movie. You cry at the sight of our young men and women in camo walking through airports on their way to foreign countries and knowing that they may not walk back home. You cry at the sight of abused kids and animals staring at you through the pages of your newspaper. You cry when Betsy tells you that she has inoperable cancer and she will never see 60. You get old. You cry for everyone but yourself because you have finally realized that, even though it's been a hard life, it has turned out to be a damn fine one, much better than you have any right to expect. You get old. You wish and hope that every person, every pet, could live such a life as you have been privileged to live. You get old. You cry for others. Because when you were young, you cried only for yourself. In the end, the only way to advance taking no notice of wickedness, of becoming truly unoffendable, is to recognize and experience that God is unoffendable first. I don't know if there's any other way to do this. It's that first love of God, that unoffendable acceptance that casts out the fear. And you can wait for old age to help you. You can do that if you want, to beat the fear out of you. Or you can start risking, letting go of the things that you're clinging to. What are those things? The things that you get offended over. Take note of them when you're offended, when you get that stab, when you feel the need to jump in and defend, to justify. That's something that you can let go of. You can just not go there. And over time, you will find out that God is not offended by you. And that's the beginning of your reincorporation, the beginning of coming back into the garden and finding the freedom that exists there. Let's pray. Father, you know exactly who we are. You know how we're wired. You know our fears. You know what still makes us run and run and run on that hamster wheel. And you understand. And you are patient. And you are unoffended. And you continue to love us the only way that you can, which is completely, without any kind of stop button or even a valve, completely open. Father, that's how we want to love. We want to love in exactly the same way. Help us. Help us through the difficult things. Help us through the things that scare us. Help us to continue to let go, to stop defending and start accepting every moment as it is, knowing that you are at the center, guiding us, cheering us on. Thank you, Father, for every breath. Thank you, Father, for the trees that I saw this morning that brought me back into a sense of you and connection. Help each one of us right now, this moment, to find something, each other's eyes, something that brings us back into connection with you this moment, that we are completely acceptable and loved in a way that we cannot lose. We love you because you first loved us. In Jesus' name, amen. Let's all stand.